All right, for those of you who were here a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we talked about beginning of what I'm calling Torah economics, something that I had studied a few years back in preparation for a discussion at the Feast of Tabernacles. We were doing what was called Yeshua Halakha and trying to determine how Yeshua applied various portions of the Torah in his life. And so my assignment that year was the economics portion of it. So anyway, that's what this is about. Last time that we talked about the fact that within the framework of God's law, he says very little about economics in regards to government as a whole. In fact, practically everything we see as far as economics is concerned is on a personal level. And as you study these things, you come to see that practically all of Yahweh's laws of economics pertain in some way to the poor. The only exception to that is the laws pertaining to tithing and the special redemption offering called the temple tax. So practically everything is in regards to the poor. And what we looked at last time was that one of the big things in regards to the poor was how God intended for the poor people to get out of their state, their state of being poor, and how they are to remedy their situation is on their own as much as possible. And so we started out by talking about gleaning of the fields. And we showed that in gleaning the fields, a farmer was responsible for allowing or for giving or leaving enough of his field for the poor to come and glean that they could provide for themselves. And if he failed to do so, it was considered as if he was trying to be demeaning to the poor person in a way. So anyway, we talked a lot about gleaning last time. But we're going to continue on with those types of thoughts this week. Yahweh is definitely concerned about the poor. And as we look at the mitzvah in the Torah, a lot of the mitzvah, the commandments of the Torah, pertain to the economic matters directed at helping the poor out of their situation. But Yahweh is not real specific about how we're to help each other or how we're to help the poor. He leaves that to leaves it pretty much to your discretion. And one of the examples we gave last week of that was the fact that God does not define the corners of the field. The corners of the field is something that you as a farmer had to decide how much you were going to leave. But one thing he did let you know that is if you didn't leave enough, then he looked at it as if you were stingy or you were not upholding your responsibility to the poor. So God said that you yourself had to be responsible for determining how big the corners of the field are. This week, we're going to move on into things pertaining to the use of servitude, how a person could serve his brother in order to get out of a poor situation, and also how a person could borrow money from his neighbor in order to help get out of the poor situation. But before we get into that, I want to take a little bit more look at what it means and what our responsibility is and how we should get a frame of mind as far as our responsibility to the poor. If any of you have ever been to a Jewish synagogue or a Messianic Jewish synagogue, you've seen what's called a Zedekah box. We've got a little box over here, and I think it says Zedekah on it right over there. A Zedekah box is a box that it's designed, it's there for the purpose of receiving offerings. The original intent of a Zedekah box was to receive offerings for the poor. The reason that a Zedekah box is called a Zedekah box is because Zedekah comes from these three Hebrew letters, Zadi, Dalet, and Kuf, and those letters together mean righteous. That's the Hebrew word for righteous. And to be righteous means to have a just cause and to be in the right. So why is it that righteousness has anything to do with giving to the poor? How do we make that connection? How do the Jewish people make the connection between righteousness, Zedekah, and the poor? They do it basically through the scripture right here. Proverbs 29:7 says, "The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked does not understand such knowledge." The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked does not understand such knowledge. So we're seeing a connection between righteousness and the cause of the poor. And so the Jewish people looked at that as to take up a collection to help the poor. So they called it a Zedekah box. Nowadays, a Zedekah box can be used for anything, and they'll put money in there to pay for the needs of the congregation or something. It's not necessarily just for the poor. But how do we take from that scripture there and find out what a righteous person's role is in helping the poor? When you look at that passage, it sort of looks like you might say that it's saying that, okay, the righteous person is going to give to the poor. Okay? The righteous person is going to give to the poor. And that's the way, if you were to get on the internet, look this verse up and see what commentators are saying about it. A lot of them are saying it's simply indication that a badge of righteousness is giving to the poor. But the Hebrew doesn't necessarily read that way. The Hebrew actually reads Zadik Din Dalim. Now, how many of you all know what that means? Okay, neither did I until I looked it up. It means in English, the righteous know to judge the poor. How many of us caught the word deen in that? Deen, judgment, okay? The righteous know to judge the poor. In fact, the Septuagint reads this verse this way. The Septuagint is always a good thing to look at. A righteous man knows how to judge for the poor. For the ungodly understands not knowledge, and the poor man has not an understanding mind. Now, this could be taken a number of ways too. One of those ways is that it takes a righteous man to make judgments for the poor. You know, a righteous man has to think for the poor. I don't think that's the case. Another person would have suggested that means that it takes a righteous person or a righteous person will make a proper judgment between a poor person and a rich person. But that's not necessarily righteousness either, because that's in Torah. Torah says that you're not to take and judge differently based on a person's wealth. Okay, everybody's supposed to be judged the same, irregardless of wealth. So it doesn't necessarily take a righteous person to do that. I submit that the meaning behind this verse is that it's our righteousness to judge the needs of a poor person. That it's our righteousness, our role and our responsibility to judge the needs of the poor. Now, what does that mean? That could mean that you look at someone and you say, well, that person's driving a brand new Mercedes and he's on the street corner begging. Okay? Now, you're going to think a little bit different about that person than the person who's driving an old beaten down bicycle and on the corner begging, right? Because we have to make judgments on those things. And a lot of the things that we judge on is appearance. And obviously a person that's driving Mercedes has probably got it's probably not as bad a shape as we might think. You know, there's relative, being poor is relative, right? How many of you saw the thing that John Stossel did on the poor and begging and stuff? It was called panhandling, yeah. And John Stossel was out on this street corner panhandling and made tons of money that day. And he finally, he said that anytime somebody would give him money, he would send one of his staff to that person and say, "Why did you give that fellow over there money?" And they would say, "Well, he was poor." And he says, "That guy's a multimillionaire. He's just down here seeing if you'll give him money." And so, you know, there's relatives. You might be out there seeing someone panhandling. They might be very well off. In fact, one of the things Stossel brought out in that article was that in many cases, people make a lot more money panhandling than they can actually working for a living. What's that?
Offer one a job.
Yeah. Offer one a job, see if he takes it, right? So anyway, it's a relative thing, but it takes us and our righteousness, or let me phrase it this way, righteousness for us can sometimes be based on how we judge a poor person's needs. And so this is why we see that in the Bible that God puts the responsibility of dealing with the poor on individuals, not on the corporate group or the government, you might say. So, last week we talked about gleaning the fields, and we found out that one of the reasons that God intended for man to, or a poor person to glean fields, was that it preserved his dignity. And as we know, in regards to panhandling, that's basically begging, right? And begging is one of the most demeaning things that a person can do, because they're having to go out there and they're basically putting themselves totally at the mercy of other peoples. But God never intended for it to be that way. God intended for man to go out and work for a living. And so one of the ways that he provided, or one of the means by which he provided for a person to take care of himself when he is poor is by gleaning. Yahweh intended for the poor to work in order to feed his family. But he also intended for the more fortunate ones, the farmers and such, to help out those less fortunate ones by leaving a way by which they could provide for themselves. And we saw one of the most famous examples of gleaning was that of Ruth the Moabitess, whose her mother-in-law Naomi was related to a very rich man and could have within Torah gone to said, "Hey, I'm a widow, you need to help take care of me." But instead, Naomi sent Ruth to glean the fields, to work the fields in order to provide for herself instead of going out and asking for money. So gleaning was one of the ways. But another way in which a man could take and provide for himself was through servitude. And there are a number of ways, another number of avenues within this broad concept of servitude that which a person could do this. And the way we're going to look at right now is that of a day laborer. Well, let's just read this real quick. Deuteronomy 24, "You shall not abuse a needy or destitute laborer, whether a fellow countryman or a stranger in one of the communities of your land. You must pay him his wages on the same day before the sun sets, for he is needy and urgently depends on it. Else he would cry out to Yahweh against you, and you will incur guilt." So a day laborer, it was a person who would go out and work for another person a day at a time. And at the end of the day, he was expected to be paid. Yeshua used this example, or an example of this, in one of his parables where he was talking about how some people were hired in the morning and other people were hired in the afternoon. But they are all expecting to get paid in the evening. So this was he was following a Torah example of a person who wanted to work. You give him work, and then you paid him at the end of the day. So this was a way by which a person could take and provide for himself in an honorable way. The reason it was an honorable way is, number one, he wanted to work. He was not asking for a handout. He wanted to work, and so he was willing to go out and work for what he was making. Secondly, is that all he expected after working was to get paid. He wasn't expecting anything beyond just simply getting paid, but he did need to get paid. And this is where a lot of the responsibility goes back upon the employer, you might say, maybe it's the landowner or whoever, whatever job he was doing that day, if he was gathering grapes for a day, whatever. The farmer, when he hired a day laborer, he had responsibilities to that day laborer. And one of the responsibilities was to make sure he had the money in the afternoon to pay him. It sounds very simple, but in many cases, it's not necessarily that way. For instance, I worked in construction for a long time. But in the early years of construction, right after I got out of high school, I would go out and work for various subcontractors, and those subcontractors would not be able to pay me unless they got paid that week themselves. So I could work all week long. Like, for instance, I framed for a while, and I would frame for this fellow, and you would always see him leaving about 12 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, because he went to the contractor he was working for in order to get a check. Then he would run to the bank and deposit that check in his account and hope that the check was good, because he was going to then write checks off of that to pay us. And there's been more than one time that he couldn't find the contractor, or the contractor himself didn't have the funds in the bank, and therefore he couldn't pay us. And so I would be here on Friday afternoon and expecting to get a paycheck, and sometimes I got a paycheck, but it was with the stipulation, you don't cash this thing until Monday, or you just didn't get a check at all. And so here I was, and I had plans for the weekend. One of those was eating, but you had no money, because I basically, those first couple of years out of high school, I just lived from paycheck to paycheck. And on Friday, I was out of money. And so I needed that check. And if I didn't get paid, I was in bad shape. And I would go, if I didn't get paid, what I found myself having to do was go borrow money from my friends in order to make it through the weekend. And I didn't like doing that. I worked for that money all week long. I expected to get paid, but I didn't get paid. But then that caused me to have to go and ask money from somebody else. And one of the worst things I ever had to do is go ask money from your parents. And I had to do that one time. I had to call my dad and say, "Dad, will you send me some money?" And my dad said, "No." So anyway, that's just the way it was. But God expects a day laborer to get paid. And therefore, the responsibility is that the employer pays that. Now, we can learn a few other things from this too. And that is, in our society today, you guys aren't employers, but I guess, Stephanie, you're not an employer, are you? As an employer, you find that you have employees, and employees have needs. And so one of the things that, after we looked at this a few years back, we realized that sometimes your employees have needs that come up unexpectedly. They may have a little buffer in their checking account. Maybe they're not working paycheck to paycheck, but they don't have enough money to pay a emergency situation. And so they come and ask for an advance. And so in the past, we were always somewhat hard-nosed in regards to advances. We wouldn't allow an employee to have an advance. And then we eventually developed a policy that said, well, we'll give you so many advances in a certain time frame. And the reason for that is because we realized that an employee who has worked for us all week long has a certain amount of money coming to him. And even though it's not scheduled to be paid to him the next week, it's still owed to him. And so we realized that as an employer, we should try to help our brother out in these dire situations by giving him this money in advance if he needed it. And part of that was based on this verse right here: do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is your power to do so. And so if you have made a commitment to somebody that if they work for you and they've performed the work, then you are expected to pay them in the biblical days. If it was a day labor job and the custom was to pay at the end of the day, you should pay at the end of the day. Our custom today is to pay at the end of the week, or in our situation, we hold back a week because we do our payroll on Mondays. But we still have this money that this person has earned. And if they do need it out of season, you might say, then we do end up going ahead and giving that to them. And we found that by doing so, sometimes we resist because, maybe so-and-so's been in 3 or 4 times, and he's always wanting an advance, and that's always a problem. And giving somebody an advance in our business is a difficult thing because it causes some bookkeeping situations. But nevertheless, we try to do it as much as we can, because we find out at the end, you've lifted the spirits of the person once you give them the advance. And if you don't give them the advance, they walk out and they're just not as, they're not as happy of a person as they would have been. And so it's somewhat demeaning, we found, to not pay a person, give them the money in advance if they truly do need it. And that follows the biblical principle that we found so far in our study of Torah economics, and that is that our responsibility to the poor is to lift their spirits, to not be demeaning to them in any way at all. So now let's look to the case of an indentured servant. This was a day laborer. Let's look at an indentured servant. An indentured servant is a different type of thing, and many people would consider this slavery, but it's not slavery. Ancient Israel was unique in its attitude regarding slavery. They were unique from all the nations round about them. And all the Canaanite, Hittite cultures, slavery was a very common thing. It was common to take your brother as a slave and actually treat him like a slave. When I say your brother, your neighbor. To actually treat him like a slave. But the children of Israel came out of 200 years of slavery, and one of the first things God instructed the Israelites was that they could not treat each other as slaves. God took a totally different attitude toward slavery than the cultures round about them. So God made laws that were much different from the laws of the other ancient Middle Eastern nations in regards to slavery. And one of the biggest differences between Israel's laws pertaining to slavery or indentured servitude was that in the Hittite and Canaanite nations, you could get a slave and the slave was yours forever. But in God's plan, you could only have an indentured servant for 6 years. 6 years was it. On the seventh year, you had to release your indentured servant. We see this here in Leviticus 25. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of the Jubilee. Now, you'll say, okay, that says till the Jubilee year. He can serve you till the Jubilee year. That means that he can serve for 50 years in some cases. Well, I don't know how to explain this. I'll just be right up front with you. I don't know how to explain this, but I can tell you this. Every other place in the Scripture, in the Torah, where it talks about servitude, it says 6 years. And on the seventh year, we release them. And then if you go down to Jeremiah, let me see if I've got it right here. Jeremiah 34:14, you'll see that Jeremiah understood this to be 6 years. Because it says, Jeremiah quotes Yahweh saying that I told you you could only have a slave for 6 years, and now you've had them for more than that. So the Torah, I think, very clearly teaches 6 years of indentured servitude is the maximum a person could do. And so how it applies to the year of the Jubilee, I'm not really sure. The year of the Jubilee, actually the Hebrew there for year of Jubilee is simply Yovel. And Yovel, the Hebrew word Yovel can mean the Jubilee, but it could also mean simply a ram's horn. So it could be a cultural thing in the Israelite culture that every 7 years on the year of release, they would blow a ram's horn. And so that may be the situation we're seeing. But the word shana, which is the word year, is not in the Scripture. You don't see it in the Hebrew. So they're getting year of Jubilee simply from the Hebrew word Yovel. But God said 6 year limit was imposed. That's it. That's all you could serve your brother for. It is also clear that a person who was an indentured servant could only would be free to go on a daily basis. Now, and to be an indentured servant meant that you had a contractual agreement with the person who took you on. Basically, what it said is that you agreed to work for this person for 6 years. In return for working for you for 6 years, you will take me into your household And you'll take my family into your household with me, and you will support me with the benefits that you've derived from me. So this person would go to work. He would go into this person's household, and maybe he would, as an Israelite, he may be one who would lead a group of other people, or maybe he was just a laborer, go out and labor in the fields every day. But the bottom line is he helped increase the wealth of the person that he was working for. And since he was increasing the wealth of that person, out of that wealth, he was paid with food and support, clothing and all that stuff for these 6 years. During that 6 years, he was considered a sojourner. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be to you. A hired servant was someone who could come to you during the day and leave that afternoon, just like the day laborer we're talking about. A sojourner is a person, is a non-Israelite who came into the land, and he could leave the land anytime. So as a sojourner, he was a part of your family, you might say, but he was not caged into your family. He was not chained into your family. He was free to come and go as he pleased, as long as he showed up and did his work. That's all there was to it. Now, why is it that God would not want a person to be owned by another Israelite? Why was he simply a laborer and not owned as a slave? It's really clear. The scripture says, "The Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves." So you could not be owned by another Israelite because you are already owned by God. And God goes on, we see this, it's in Matthew 6, we see Yeshua saying that no man can serve two masters. So if you could not be owned by Yahweh and then owned by another person. And the Israelites were unique. They were all owned by Yahweh. But we'll get into that next week in the parasha, because Yahweh redeemed them from Pharaoh. He paid a price for them. So they are his possession now. And thus they cannot be owned by another person. So the Israelites, when they became an indentured servant, they became what's called a sakir, which simply means a wage earner, a person who earns wages. But unlike a day laborer, who is also a sakir, an indentured servant did not get his wages during the 6 years that he worked for this person. Instead, he would get his wages afterwards. Why would a person sell himself to another? To understand that, we've got to understand the fact that Israel was an agrarian society, and God meant for the people to provide themselves primarily by the land. God was, you know, we've talked about them being in a sharecropping situation with God. They were to take and work the land, and then God would provide them the rain and everything, and that's how they would make their income and their wealth. But if a person was a poor farmer, maybe he was a lazy farmer, or maybe he had an illness or something that didn't allow him to get his crops in the field in the proper time, any number of things could happen. And if something happened bad that would cause him to where he didn't have a crop, or in any way could not provide for his family, one of the easiest things for him to do would be to go to work for another person and simply work for another person. And as such, he could take and provide for his family. And God never intended that for that to be a demeaning thing. Working for someone else was never intended to be a demeaning thing. And so they would just go work for someone else. And especially if they didn't have skills. When I say work from someone else as an indentured servant, I mean you know, they were contracted to that one person, unlike the day laborer who could go to work for anybody around. So he would contract himself to that person, and that would alleviate him of the need to go find jobs every day. And he may even find it easier to simply not farm than it, and simply work for someone else and be under someone else's management. In fact, most people today would rather work for somebody else than work for themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. Employers need employees. And so it's a good relationship, and we're glad that people are willing to do that. And it's not meant to be demeaning, nor was it back then. So he would work his 6 years, and at the end of the 6 years, it says that he would be sent away. Now, it doesn't say that he would just simply up and leave. The scripture actually indicates that he would be sent away. This is the Septuagint. The Septuagint reads this in Deuteronomy 15:12. And if your brother or sister, a Hebrew man or a woman, be sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall send him out free from you. The Hebrew there for send out is shalach. And we're all familiar with that term, shalach. It's the same word from which we get the word apostle from in the New Testament. It's one sent out. So it says that in the sixth year or after in the seventh year, he should be sent out. But he's not just sent out. He just not said, okay, your 6 years is up, now go. He was sent out with part of the livestock from which he had helped nurture during the years. He was sent out with produce. He was sent out with grapes. In fact, the Hebrew there actually indicates that he was encircled with wealth. He was actually encircled with wealth. So the reason he was encircled with wealth is because he helped build that wealth. In fact, Yahweh in another scripture, I don't have it written down, he says that you, as a landowner, as an employer, you should not get upset when you had to send him out, because you got a double portion during the year that he was working for you. Because he was working for you, you didn't have to pay him while he was working, and you got all this extra wealth as a result of him. So therefore, you share some of that wealth with him and send him out. And the purpose for that was then to get him back, get him a good start once again in life. Maybe he could go buy back his land or whatever, and he could get another good start. So being an indentured servant, bottom line, being an indentured servant was not a demeaning thing. It was a good thing for the Israelites, and it was one of the ways that God provided for the Israelites to be able to take care of themselves in the case that they got in a bad financial situation. Another thing that is another avenue by which God provided for the Israelites to help themselves when they're in a bad situation is the context of the kinsman redeemer, the Gael. We've talked a lot about the kinsman redeemer, so I'm not going to cover it here today. Just if you want to read about the kinsman redeemer, it's in Leviticus 25. But basically, the kinsman redeemer's responsibility was to take and try to buy the land of a person who had to sell his land for whatever reason, try to buy the land back from them and maybe give it back to the original owner or hold it for the original owner until they could take and buy themselves out of slavery or until the end of the 6 years is up. Whatever it is, it was the purpose of being able to get the land back in the hands of the person that lost the land temporarily. So we won't necessarily talk about that today. But the next thing I want to talk about, though, is in regards to loaning money. Loaning money was one of the final ways, you might say, that God provided for a person to take or be able to supply his needs in the event that he ended up in a bad way. We know, even in our society today, that if we borrow money, it puts a hardship on us. And one of the reasons it puts a hardship on us is because, first thing, we may realize that what we borrowed the money to buy, we really didn't need. But secondly, when we borrow money, there's this little thing attached to it called interest. And interest usually causes us a little bit more problem than simply borrowing the money. In our society today, we look at those people who loan money as bad. Especially nowadays, we look at people who loan money as evil, You hear it on the news all the time about the evil Wall Street bankers and all that stuff. We fail to realize that it's those same Wall Street bankers that charge interest also pay us interest when we take and put money in the bank. We don't ever talk about how evil it is for them to pay us interest, but nevertheless, we get upset when they charge us interest. But interest is a way of life in our society today. But it wasn't necessarily a part of the Israelite way of life as much as it was a part of the ancient Hittite and Canaanite cultures. The ancient Hittite and Canaanite cultures used interest in a very demeaning way. And one of those ways was that they would try to get people to have to borrow money and then charge an interest rate by which they could never pay it back. And as such, then they could take them as their slaves. We talked earlier about how in those cultures you could take and become a slave even though you're of the same native background, okay? One of the ways you could become a slave back in those cultures was through the use of interest. You would borrow money. And who would borrow money if they knew they had to pay a high interest rate? Only those people who really had to have it. And who would those people be? It would be the poor. So the poor were the ones who were saddled with this high interest back in those days. So one of the very first things that God did once he brought ancient Israel out of Egypt was to take and forbid them from charging interest of the, from their of their poor brother. They were forbidden to take interest of their brother, and in the event they even made a loan to their brother, there was restrictions made. For instance, if you needed money to get you through the day, okay, or you needed food, because they also charged interest on food. If you needed money to get through the day, and someone said, okay, I'll give you this food to get you through the day, but I'm going to take your coat as collateral. God said that in regards to the Israelite, that if that Israelite could not pay you back that evening, you had to give him his coat back anyway. So God forbid them to holding on to collateral of the poor people, especially if the collateral was something that they absolutely had to have as necessity. In fact, God completely forbid the Israelites to take collateral from a widow. It was totally forbidden to take collateral of a widow. But why would a person borrow money in the day and not be able to take and pay it back that evening? Maybe because he was a day laborer and his employer couldn't pay him, okay? Sort of like the situation I was in there at a couple times. So this day laborer thing and this pledging your garment sort of ties together in a way, possibly, because the people were dependent on others to help them out. Another thing that we see in regards to a loaning of money was that people had to take and if they borrowed money, the loaner, the person loaned money, could not collect the money if the debt was not unpaid by the year of release. And this was sort of a sticky situation. I think I've got a verse for that. Yeah. Let's just read this. If among you one of your brothers should become poor, you shall not harden your heart or set your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart and say, the seventh year, the year of release is near, and you give him nothing, and he cried to Yahweh against you. So in regards to loaning money, one of the things that God provided for the Israelites was the opportunity to have their loans completely forgiven on the seventh year. Now, what was the reason for that? I don't know. I just don't know, because it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But we do know that God said that if you do give to your brother freely, and it says in Deuteronomy, well, let me see, I don't have it up there. Deuteronomy 15:10 says, you shall give him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because For this, Yahweh your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. So I would submit, that was Deuteronomy 15:10. I would submit, but maybe the reason God did this and put this 7-year limit on loans was that it helped the righteous develop their righteousness. Because then they would have, if I loaned you money and it's only 2 years to the year of release and I know that you're not going to be able to pay it back, but I give it to you anyway, then I have the trust that Yahweh is in effect going to pay that loan back for me through the blessings he's going to provide us. And so this was a way for the righteous to build their righteousness, you might say, by making these types of loans. So they made these loans not knowing that they would ever be paid back. And this actually caused some problems with the Jewish people in the first century, or actually the first century B.C. In the first century B.C., that was during the times of Hillel and Shammai. You remember those guys? They had this policy, or actually, let me give you a little background first. There was apparently a drought or something during those years, and there was an excess of poor people in that first century B.C., during those years sometime. That was before Yeshua, maybe 50 or 100 years before Yeshua. And there was a lot of poor, but because of the year of release, the rich Jewish people would not take and loan to the poor because they knew they weren't going to get their money back due to the year of release. And so during that time, Rabbi Hillel made this edict, or this judgment, you might say, which is commonly referred today as Prospel. And Prospel is started by Hillel in the first century BCE. And basically what it does, it takes and corrupts this verse we just read, Deuteronomy 15:9. It corrupts that verse because in a corrupt reading of that verse, you see where it says, "You shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother." Hillel took that verse and he twisted it around to make it look like that when you make a loan to somebody, you write it out on a piece of paper and you stick it in your hand, and the loan is what's in your hand. Okay, so I'm loaning Dorothy money, but that money is wrapped up in my hand and I'm giving it to her, and there's a contract there and I'm handing it to her. Hillel took that, he twisted that around, even though that's not what at all it says. It doesn't say that any close to that in the Hebrew. He took that and said, well, you can take this loan that was in your hand, and on the end of the sixth year, you can take that loan and you can hand it to the court. This is the Sanhedrin. All right. So by handing it to the Sanhedrin, and since the Sanhedrin is not a person, but a entity, like a corporation, you might say, the corporation is not subject to Torah. The entity is not subject to Torah. So therefore, I'm giving the loan to the court. The court now owns the loan, so the loan now is between the court and the person who borrowed the money. The court can hold that loan for the entire year, of the whole entire year of release. And at the end of the year of release, the court can give the loan back to me, and then I can go ahead and say, okay, Dorothy, you still owe me that money. This is what Hillel did in the first century BCE, called Prospel. You can read all about it in the Mishnah. And he was looked down upon very bad by the rabbis of later years for doing so, because they recognized it as a total corruption of the Torah. But it was a judgment he made, and in fact, history will point out that it did solve the problem. It did solve the problem. The people did start loaning money to the poor. The poor were able to make it through the rough years, and most of them were able to pay their loans back, though not within the time frame the Torah dictates. And thus, a whole generation, you might say, of Jewish people were maintained because of what Hillel did. Right or wrong, we don't know. That's, there again, it was a total corruption of the Torah, but it did work. So anyway, just thought you might be interested in that. But the bottom line when it comes to borrowing money is that borrowing money, if you're a poor person and you have to borrow money, you are already in a bad state. And you are already in a humbled state. And having to go ask for money from someone, already being in a humble state, is further demeans your spirit. It further makes you less of a person, you might say. And thus, borrowing money was the least advantageous way of getting through a poor or a bad situation. Gleaning was probably the best way. An indentured servant was probably the next best way. Or a day laborer was the next best. Maybe a day laborer was the best. I don't know. But nevertheless, probably the worst thing a person could do in order to get through a bad situation was to go borrow money. So God tried to make it as good as he could on the Israelites by prohibiting them from charging interest to the poor. We see that prohibition show up very early in the Torah, and that's in Exodus 22. Exodus 22, 25, if you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a moneylender to them. You shall not charge him interest. The Hebrew word there is for interest is nashak, and it means to bite. It means to bite. It's the same word used to describe a snake, because a snake bites. In the case of when the plague went through all of Israel, and they ended up setting up the image, the snakes that went through, they neshet the people. They bit the people. So this is what interest is. It's called a bite. And if you look at the Hebrew word picture, the nun, the sheen, and the kuf, the nun means life. The sheen means teeth. What do you do with your teeth? You bite. And the kuf is the back of the head. And the Hebrew word picture by some people indicates that it is destroying the last vestige of life that a person has. And the reason it destroys the last vestige of life is that when a person gets to the point they have to borrow money in order to make it through the day or to feed his family, he's basically realizing he will have no life left. Because if he charged interest. Because if you're charged interest, you will never be able to pay that loan off. That's the way it was understood. And so you wanted to avoid borrowing money, and especially borrowing money at interest. And so God made it prohibited the Israelites from loaning money at interest to the poor. Now, some will say, well, you're prohibited from loaning money at interest to anybody. Well, that's not the case, because God very clearly says that you can loan interest, or you can charge interest to the stranger. So charging interest to the stranger was not illegal in the Torah. And the reason why is, think about it, okay? If you were a stranger, that means you came from one of these other nations. You're a Canaanite, or maybe you came from one of the Hittite nations, or you came from one of the Babylonian nations or something like that. You came from a nation where in their culture they charged high interest. And so if you came to Israel, you are more likely to be able to borrow money at a lower interest rate, at a much lower interest rate. You've got to keep in mind that God intended for Israel to be a loaner nation. Remember? It's in the end of Deuteronomy. I don't have the passage written down, but at the end of Deuteronomy, God says, "You shall loan to other nations and not borrow." So God intended for Israel to loan to other nations, but Israel was to loan to other nations at a reasonable rate, unlike their neighbor nations who charged exorbitant interest rates. So that's why I believe that God would allow them to charge interest to another nation, to another person's, but they couldn't charge interest to their Hebrew brother. But we look at this next, the next place where we see this concept of interest is in Leviticus 25. And it says, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. So what God was interested in was making sure that the people did not loan, did not take advantage of their poor brother when they loaned money or loaned food to them. They couldn't profit off their brother's misfortune. So God prohibited any type of profiteering at the expense of a poor person. If you look at the words in here for, it says, let me see. If one of your brothers becomes poor and falls into poverty. If you look at the Hebrew words there for poor and falling into poverty, it actually indicates that he's not only poor, he's also depressed and he's shaken. He's depressed, obviously, because of his financial situation, but he's shaken because he's in dire straits. He needs help, absolutely needs help. And that passage actually indicates that if he's in that condition, you are to take him into your home. Take him into your home and take care of them for a short period of time, and then possibly loan them money to get started again. So it's not just a situation of being poor. This is a desperate, very desperate situation. If you're in that desperate situation, you cannot profit off of your brother. You cannot loan him money at interest. Now, the next passage that I'm going to give you here is the one that I believe causes a little bit of confusion in regards to if you're able to loan money at interest to your Israelite brother for any reason or not. And this is Deuteronomy 23:19, where it says, "You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest." Okay, now, let's look at this and look at a few things in regards to the context of what we're seeing here. Number one, this is Deuteronomy, all right? Some people look at Deuteronomy as a second giving of the law, or as an addition to the law, or a more clear defining of the law. But I believe if you study the book of Deuteronomy, you'll realize that the book of Deuteronomy is simply Moses' reiteration of the Torah to the next generation. So Moses didn't add anything here. In fact, there were things here that were simply understood, though not said. And so since we see in the book of Exodus and in the book of Leviticus that God says that you cannot loan to the poor, then I would say that loaning money to the poor is the unwritten context of what we have here. This passage is also found within a whole litany of commandments that are not necessarily related to one another or to any other thing. So it looks like Moses is just simply spelling this reiterating stuff one right after another without taking the time to actually explain these things to the Israelites. And I would say that he did that mostly because these people already knew a lot of these things. He was just getting it on record that he told them again. So Deuteronomy is not a different Torah, and it's not addition to the Torah. It's just the Torah reiterated to the second generation. Second thing we need to understand is that, as I said earlier, Yahweh did not forbid all forms of usury. It was okay to charge usury to the non-Israelite. So we know that God didn't have a problem necessarily with usury. He had a problem with charging usury to money loaned to the poor. And you'll see that here. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that's lent. Person wouldn't necessarily want to go borrow food and then pay it back. But you would only borrow food if you were destitute and you needed to be fed, or you had a family that needed to be fed. You would do whatever you could to do it. So if your brother loaned you some food with the assumption that next summer you're going to pay that food back to him because you'll have a good crop, then God is saying you can't charge interest on that food. You can't say, okay, you're going to have to add a fifth to that. Remember that if you took something of your brother's and you didn't return it, then if you ever did try to make it right, you always had to add a fifth to it, right? So what we're seeing here is that a person who's charging interest is treating his brother as if he had wronged him. And so God did not want that to happen. He didn't want this addition or this profit being made off of helping his brother out. One other reason God, I believe, would allow the Israelites to charge interest is to stop the wholesale use of borrowing money. If the other nations knew that Israel had money to loan or had food to loan or something like that, and if there was no interest involved, then these nations would come over and say, "Hey, loan me this, loan me this, loan me, and I'll pay you back someday." You know, they may fully intend to pay it back, but without interest being charged, then that would cause the wholesale borrowing of money, which is something we saw in our economy during the 1990s. We had interest rates that were so low that people borrowed money that they couldn't afford to repay. And thus we have an economic crisis today that's crushing us and going to be crushing our kids. So interest when used properly, prevents a number of problems within a culture and a society. So I don't think that God is in this verse wholesale saying you cannot charge interest at all. But you know, saying that, the official policy within Judaism is that all forms of interest or usury is illegal. That's the official policy within Judaism. You get on just about any Jewish website and look up usury, and they'll tell you that officially you cannot charge usury. The only time you can charge usury is if you first consult a rabbi. You know, that's what they'll say. So, they're saying it's an official policy that you can't charge usury, and they will base that on the fact that in the first century, Hillel said you couldn't charge usury, though Hillel himself corrupted the Torah in order to loan money. Okay, but there was a rabbi in the first century that did talk about usury, about loaning money out, and that was Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua in Matthew 25 says this. This was a parable of the talents. And he says, "But his master answered him, saying, 'You wicked and slothful servant.'" This is the last one who came back and didn't invest the money. "You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sowed and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest." So Yeshua is using this as an example of how we should be, that we should at least get interest on our money. If we're given something and we're given safekeeping of something, then we should have a gain from it, and that we should be able to give him back a gain. And of course, the context of this is that God gives us understanding of his way, that we can't just keep it to ourselves. We've got to go out and try to do something with it, try to increase it. And so he uses the example of interest. So Yeshua, Rabbi Yeshua, contrary to Rabbi Hillel, is saying that yes, interest in the right amount is certainly permissible. So what we see from this is that God has given us economic laws that are designed to help the poor. They help the poor climb out of their unfortunate financial state, and they're designed to help one another. In no case do we find a law that instructs the national government to give to the poor. It's all done on a local and individual basis. And there again, you know, we don't have to go ask a rabbi if we can charge interest, or we don't have to go ask a rabbi how big of a corner our field should be. We simply should use our own judgment, because God is going to base us, our helping the poor, but based on our judgments, not on the judgment of some other person. So what is a righteous person? A righteous man is the one who knows how to judge the poor. He judges the needs of the poor, and he tries to provide for them in the appropriate way. So next time when we do this, we're going to talk about tithing. this pretty much covers all of the needs of the poor, but there are a little bit of that in regards to tithing. So we'll look at tithing and see what we can find out about that. So with that, I say shalom aleichem. Aleichem shalom. Have a good evening.